How did you get from RISD to here?
Right. Well, I took a plane.
Yeah.
That is, well, you know what? I like to say that the primary, quantitatively, the largest interlocutors of our public discourse are stand-up comedians. It couldn't possibly be worse if it's an artist, right?
Yeah.
So it's an unconventional path, but through doing this social media research, I became a source for pull quotes from a lot of journalists. So Taylor Lorenz was someone I talked to very early on, the OK Boomer piece. I was the researcher that was cited in that. And my peer group, this is artists who are of the post-internet generation, we were writing about memetics and influence on social media. So we already had this kind of academy style of discourse around primarily silly posts on the internet. And then all of a sudden, some of those people became tremendously wealthy and powerful. And some of the bloggers who are espousing like fringe ideas back in like 2010 now have a direct line to the administration, and people are talking about monarchy in 2025. So, yeah, it's an unconventional path, but you know, there just weren't that many journalists who were doing this stuff, and they were getting the stories wrong in many cases.
It's interesting.
So, yeah, I would often cite your work. I guess the unusual situation I found myself in was that I was in these elite academies, art museums, universities, and I would be writing about the memes that literal teenagers, ages like 12 to 17 at the beginning, would they'd post about the calculation debate. They'd post about transhumanism, the widest Overton window you can imagine. And then the gatekeepers, the kind of people who should know which way the wind is blowing in political discourse, unfortunately, we're not up to the task being able to predict what was happening in culture and politics at the moment. So I found myself in this very unusual situation where the kids, who seemingly had no political education or knowledge of history, were in some cases making claims that turned out to be true later on. And yeah, we find ourselves in the midst of, I'm going to ask you a lot of questions about political order as well. So yeah, there's much to go over, but
All right.
I would cite your work. Francis Fukuyama, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Historian Gary Gerstle writes about New Deal liberalism, neoliberalism. We now may be entering some new political order. How should we understand what comes next?
That's a really tough question because I think that a lot of people are abandoning liberalism, but the main problem is that I don't see any consistent alternative that, you know, it's both on the left and the right, but within either group, you don't really have a single vision of what, you know, moving away from liberalism would look like. So I find it impossible to answer that question, really.
Would anyone in their right mind describe the presidency of FDR as being akin to a startup or a monarchy?
It was like that in the sense that you know, the old system was broken, and actually for the first few years, FDR really did not have a plan. I mean, he was just throwing spaghetti up on the wall to see what would stick. And so, you know, you have the National Recovery Act, you have the Civilian Conservation Corps, a whole bunch of agencies just appeared, and then they disappeared within the next, you know, 3, 4 years. And so in that respect, it was like a startup. I mean, it was being very innovative and very experimental without having a clear vision of what would actually work. And it really took until, you know, the time of the Second World War until it shook out into, you know, these agencies that we now associate with the New Deal, like Social Security and, you know, this sort of thing.
You mentioned Social Security before. I think there was an assumption when I was growing up that certain elements of liberal democracy were more or less invulnerable to being rolled back. And we see Trump is now maybe on the threshold of cutting Social Security, which was unimaginable a few decades ago. Do you think that this kind of transformation is actually going to happen?
You have to do something about Social Security and Medicare, because if you simply do the, you know, the accounting out for another couple of decades, they're just going to go bankrupt. And this is kind of a third rail that nobody's been willing to touch up till now. And Trump did not distinguish himself. You know, it was Paul Ryan that was talking about doing something about entitlements, and he was kind of the old news in the Republican Party. But I think that, you know, it's a question that somebody is going to have to wrestle with, and the question is whether they do it in a responsible way or whether, you know, they do it in a really destructive way. And I really don't trust Trump to, you know, follow the ladder.
Is there maybe an argument to be made for not allowing patents like Ozempic to be held by private companies?
You know, the basic market incentives require that you have patents that are owned by drug companies. It's just that they don't have to be permitted to make as much money as they do off of a monopoly situation.
Right.
Right. The monopoly is actually created by the government because, you know, the government is what protects the patent. But you can put all sorts of restrictions on, you know, that. Just to get back to the Social Security issue, there are plenty of ways that you can start dealing with that looming crisis that are responsible. For example, you know, I'm 72 now. I get a Social Security check. I don't need it. You know, you could means test Social Security, and if you've saved enough money that you know you can live perfectly well, there's no reason why the government should be paying you. The easiest thing to do is to raise the retirement age. People hate this. This almost brought Putin down, you know, and it almost brought Macron down. I mean, actually in France, they've got this ridiculously early. I think for women, it's like 61 or 62. And that means that, you know, given, so when the retirement age of 65 was first created under Bismarck in Germany in the late 19th century, that was about the life expectancy of most people.
You
drop dead at 65, so the government wouldn't have to cover you. Today, you know, the average age at birth, life expectancy at birth is like 85, which means that if you retire at 65, somebody's got to cover you when you're not working for the next 20 years. And, you know, that's, I think, the crisis, you know, that's been created. But people don't want to admit that that's the case. You know, they want to be able to retire. And the political opposition to doing anything responsible about that is really, really strong.
How do you feel about Stephanie Kelton's work, MMT? You can dilute the money supply. You can spend, the state can spend up until full employment to increase productive capacity.
Oh, you mean this is the modern...
Without creating inflationary
monetary,
effects.
Ridiculous. I mean, I think it's been refuted by the inflation that we've had. I mean, I don't think that's going to work. I think that actually what happened to the world is that when China entered the world trading system in the early 2000s in a big way, it had a huge deflationary impact because they're so big and they're so efficient that basically everything got cheaper, and that was a one-time shock to the system. There's never going to be another equivalent of China entering the global system. And then for the next 20 years, you know, it was almost impossible to get inflation going because of, I think, that downward, you know, supply pressure. But that's gone now. And, you know, if you print too much money, you're going to get inflation.
Are open borders a Koch brothers policy?
A policy of the Koch brothers?
There's a famous quote from Bernie Sanders. This is back 2015-16 on the Ezra Klein podcast, where Ezra asks him about open borders, and Bernie responds, "That's a Koch brothers proposal."
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it wasn't exclusively a Koch brothers proposal. I mean, I think a lot of progressives were also in favor of open borders. But it's certainly true that classic Reagan-style American libertarian conservatives, you know, liked immigration. And, you know, they did not want a lot of, you know, strict border enforcement.
I think this is one of the underappreciated arguments in your very famous book, is that you do spend quite a long amount of time talking about the ways in which authoritarian regimes can have these explosive growth rates because of their power, their executive power, command economy, and so on. How do you view these enormous growth rates from China, like 5.5, I think, in 2024?
Well, so first of all, I'm not sure I believe that number.
People say it's inflated.
Yeah, I think that they've got a lot of ways of inflating their growth numbers, and everybody in the Chinese system is incentivized to overstate, you know, how well they're doing. I think that it could be entirely possible that they'll end up like Japan after the 1990s, where they're bump along at 1-2% growth for a long period, because it's really hard to get out of the kind of high-level trap that they're in right now. In terms of being able to create employment, they've kind of harvested all the low-hanging fruit, and now it's going to be much harder to get, you know, really explosive growth. For example, I think they made a big mistake in the early 2010s. Everybody understood that they were facing a slowdown in their old growth model. What they should have been doing is investing in domestic demand, in, you know, pensions for retirees and healthcare and better education, especially for people living in rural China. And instead, what Xi Jinping decided to do was to double down on exports and manufacturing.
Right.
This time it would be high tech, you know, it would be semiconductors and solar panels and electric cars and this sort of thing. But they way over invested in it. And they tried to do this at a moment when the rest of the world had decided that they had too much Chinese stuff to begin with. And you see this right away in the United States. It's not just Trump that doesn't want Chinese imports. You know, Joe Biden kept the tariffs that Trump had started because, you know, I think that everybody has now recognized that China's entry into the world trading system just killed several million manufacturing jobs in the United States. Right now, the German or European car industry is under a similar kind of threat from Chinese EVs. And I think if they are sensible, they're, you know, if all you're interested in is economic efficiency, yeah, you'd buy Chinese EVs. Hmm. If you're interested in social stability, given the importance of the car industry in Europe and especially in Germany, I would protect it.
Hmm. You mean social stability in terms of like middle class
jobs? Yeah, I mean, if what happens in Germany to their car industry is what happened to, you know, steel and manufacturing in the United States in the early 2000s, you're going to have a social revolution on your hands. And so I think in the interest of social stability, you actually need to keep these, you know, these Chinese products out. And I think generally speaking, the rest of the world, they can only take so much stuff manufactured in China. And that's the problem with this kind of, you know, heavy state involvement in investment is they don't always make, you know, it's not their money, so they're not making good choices.
So I completely agree about this Chinese overcapacity in manufacturing. Would it stand to reason that Xi making that decision wanted to drain political stability from potential competitors in the 21st century? That overcapacity in manufacturing rather than, as you said, pensions and taking care of people so that they would have the purchasing power within China, that they actually wanted to drain middle class jobs from Europe and the United States?
Yeah, I don't know whether they were thinking in terms of jobs so much as just wanting to dominate, you know, cutting-edge technologies, because clearly that was kind of China 2025. That was their plan. And I think that some of that had a pure strategic rationale. If they dominate those technologies, they're also going to dominate a whole host of military technologies that will be important, you know, if there's a war in the future. And the jobs part of it might have been, you know, destabilizing Western societies may have been an auxiliary benefit that they get out of it, but I'm not sure that that's what was driving their strategy.
On this topic of bringing back manufacturing to the United States, there's a very peculiar overlap where Trump has spoken about this quite a bit, bringing jobs back, bringing back factories. There was also, I believe, around the 2010s, the IMF started to make these arguments that superpowers would withdraw their manufacturing for like essential parts of their energy supply chain. So green energy, their chips, that if we do indeed go to war with another superpower, we can't lose 20% of our energy capacity overnight. Does that strike you as a bit ironic that the anti-globalist candidate is taking the policy prescriptions from the IMF?
Well, he's extending them in ways that I don't think the sensible anti-globalist did. I mean, I think that the COVID epidemic and then the Ukraine war demonstrated that the kind of interdependence that had grown up was just not safe because it could be used as a strategic weapon. So all the oil and gas that the Europeans were buying from Russia, you know, was fueling their war machine and, you know, could be turned against them. And so it was sensible to, you know, to get out of, you know, that sector. Similarly, in COVID, we began to realize that in medical technology, we're incredibly dependent. You know, so in the early stages of the pandemic, there wasn't enough protective gear and all this because China, you know, made all of it. So I think that, you know, there's this realization that you had to pull back and become a little bit more self-sufficient in these critical things that would happen in the event of an overt conflict. But, you know, Trump has this vision, you know, not just of protecting yourself that way, but of kind of going back to the 1950s where people, you know, men are working in steel mills and lifting heavy objects and this sort of thing. And I just think that this is sort of a fantasy, that it's not going to happen that way.
In your view, is China trending towards the Western model, or is the Western model trending towards China?
China, in 2013, when Xi Jinping took over, looked very hopeful because they had liberalized. I don't think they're ever going to democratize in the sense of having multi-party, free and fair elections, but they can certainly become more liberal in the sense of being more open. You can do what you want. You can say stuff. You can criticize the government, you know, this sort of thing.
Hmm.
And it was pretty good in the 1990s. I remember, you know, I went to China at least once a year, talked to your friends there. They can say who's up, who's down. They can make snide comments about what the Communist Party is doing. They're free to do that. And that all reversed after Xi took over. And now, you know, they've got a commissar in every, you know, university faculty department. They, you know, you have to watch what you say on social media. And in fact, the degree of social control, it's historically doesn't have a precedent, because now you can use modern technology to surveil your population to a degree that's just unheard of. Right. So we do this, except it's called Google. Right.
Hi, everybody. This is Joshua Citarella. What you just heard is an excerpt from this week's bonus episode. If you want to hear more and get access to the full catalog for Doomscroll and other podcasts, you can support the show on Patreon or Substack, where I'm putting out new episodes every week. This is an independent show. I don't do any advertising, so your support is really what keeps this project going. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.